Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
No, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. On today's show, Strangers in a Strange Land, the world's most famous, or is that infamous, Kazakh, Borat, comes to USNA, plus Massacre Theater, music by M. Ward, and our top five culture clash movies.
We'll also hand out our Best of the Documentaries Marathon Awards, The Nanooks. But first, the latest shiny happy film from director Alejandro González Iñárritu and screenwriter Guillermo Arriaga, Babel.
You see how easy it is to get into paradise?
Is this Mexico?
Maybe it's Mexico.
My mom told me that Mexico is really dangerous.
Sí. Está lleno de mexicanos.
The first collaboration between director Alejandro González Iñárritu and screenwriter Guillermo Arriaga, 2000's Amores Perros, weaves together three separate stories all taking place in Mexico City that converge at the end with a terrible car accident. Their second collaboration, 2003's 21 Grams, also tells three stories and has a tragic accident connecting the characters, but the narrative is much more fractured. The stories are nonlinear and overlap. Their latest movie, Babel, is an interesting hybrid of the previous two. Again, we have separate but intertwined stories with a tragic accident connecting them. Babel is also technically nonlinear. We see certain events conclude in one storyline before they have occurred in the next, but the narrative is far less experimental and challenging to follow than 21 Grams because the individual stories pick up where they last left off. And just to get us all oriented, Sam, I'll briefly sketch out our main characters and storylines. We have Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt playing a grieving American couple on vacation in Morocco. We have two Moroccan boys and their father, a farmer, who gives them a rifle to keep the jackals away from their goats. A Mexican housekeeper caring for two American kids while their parents, Blanchett and Pitt, are away in Morocco. And a Japanese girl who is both deaf and mute, struggling with her awakening sexuality and the recent suicide of her mother. Now, Sam, we both love Amores Perros, and you like 21 Grams even better. Is Babel, my number two and your number one most anticipated movie of 2006, another step forward for this talented pairing, or perhaps a step back? Is it possible that Iñárritu and Arriaga need to find a new shtick?
Yes, vaudeville performers Iñárritu and Arriaga.
Sure.
Working out their stick. I think the answer to your question is yes and no, but mostly no, as far as I'm concerned. No, their shtick is not entirely played out, although according to rumors they may not want to play together anymore.
That's true.
I say that because for me the pleasure of Iñárritu's films and the Arriaga Iñárritu films have little to do with the non-linear storytelling. So if the complexity of juggling multiple narratives is what keeps movie making interesting for him and Arriaga, then so be it, because I happen to love all of their collaborations, including Babel. And, as 21 Grams was better than Amores Perros, as far as I'm concerned, I think Babel is even better than 21 Grams. I mean, the scale of it, just the ambitious scale of it. I totally went for that ride, and I found it immensely satisfying. And I think it's just one of the most intelligent and exciting and really, truly moving films I've seen all year. But I will admit, going back to your question, that the flaws of the film, the flaws of a film like Babel, but also Amores Perros and 21 Grams, are related to the movie's narrative ambitions and to their shtick, if you will. For example, in Babel, you talk about the three stories. And I think, like Amores Perros, there was the third story that was sort of less interesting than the other two. And in Babel, we do have the story, you talked about the deaf-mute girl in Tokyo dealing with her sexuality. There's a real mystery to how it's related to the other two stories. It's very explicit how the other two stories are related. And it's sort of distracting to try to figure out how this third story is related. And when you finally learn it, it really doesn't justify all the time you spent with that character, that story. That being said, I still loved spending time with that character. I loved the story as it took place in Tokyo. I loved Iñárritu's observation of that community, that teenage deaf-mute community. Totally fascinating, but I was distracted by the fact that I didn't know why and ultimately didn't care how it was related to this other story. So I think it's like, boy, they would have been just fine with those two stories. They would have been a completely moving and ambitious film right there. And, so I think that's a problem, too, with 21 Grams.
Mm-hmm.
And they throw in maybe one other element that doesn't necessarily contribute to the overall picture.
Yeah, it does sort of feel tacked on compared to, really, it's not two stories. It's really kind of three stories, because you have the Mexican immigrant housekeeper, you have the Blanchett and Brad Pitt storyline, and then, of course, the Moroccan boys and their father. That is kind of its own storyline as well. And those are all explicitly connected. You have that right off the bat. And the Japanese girl does seem a little bit oddly thrown in there. I'll agree with that. And you know, this film, you've got cinematography by Rodrigo Prieto, who shot Brokeback Mountain. He shot 21 Grams and Amores Perros, and music by Gustavo Santaolalla, who also did the compositions for those same films, Brokeback Mountain, 21 Grams, Amores Perros. And this film, I think, universally has great acting in it. I think all the non-stars that we see in this film, the Japanese girl, the Moroccan characters, all of those foreign characters that we don't recognize as movie stars and aren't movie stars, I think are wonderful in this film. And even, you know how much I dislike Brad Pitt, what I saw in the trailer actually ends up being true. I think he's really interesting here. He doesn't have that nice little mouth tick of his that I can't stand. He never annoyed me in this film. I actually thought he was really interesting in this role. And, of course, Blanchett is great. And, unfortunately, even though he's wasted, our boy, Gael García Bernal, is fantastic in the few scenes that he is in. This is film, I'm saying all this to show you that the acting, the cinematography, the music, it's technically a brilliant film. Really, it is, and one that I was really engaged in
for a
good 90 minutes, but here comes the hammer, Sam. I'm sure this isn't what Arriaga and Iñárritu are going for, and they would probably be really horrified to find that anyone was reacting this way, but I find this movie unpleasant and sadistic in a way that I found really off-putting. The events that happen in Amores Perros are really hard to take as well, and in 21 Grams, too. They're, you know, it's a troubling, challenging film, but the difference for me, at least as I recall Amores Perros, having seen it 6 years ago now, is that all of these films are really about bad things happening to essentially good people, but at least in Amores Perros, you get the sense that these characters are active. They are somehow contributing. They are helping to bring about their own downfall, and yes, they have some bad luck, but it isn't a case where it seems like the universe is just out to condemn these people. They make some choices that backfire, and they end up causing them pain. And we can all relate to that, whether we share anything in common with these characters or not in our daily lives. Babel really is ultimately just about bad luck and huge misunderstandings. And if that's what they want me to take away from the film, to understand about the world, that the world is full of huge misunderstandings and unfortunate things happening to good people, okay, I guess I knew that coming into the film. The characters to me feel like nothing more than pawns in this kind of sadistic game, and I think, you know, we're forced to watch as one bad thing after another happens to them, and rather than feel bad for them, I just really started to dislike the filmmakers for making me so uncomfortable. Seeing the visual similarity, for example, of Cate Blanchett lying on the ground early in the film, dying, or coming close to dying after being shot, and then later her daughter lying in the same position in a Mexican desert, that's not interesting or symbolic or profound. I actually just thought it was kind of mean. To be honest.
Interesting. Well, you make some interesting points, but I think by sort of putting aside this notion of is this the point of the film? We live in a world that may be increasingly smaller in terms of the way we impact each other's lives. Mm-hmm. We still misunderstand each other. I think that's actually a really moving notion that they investigate, because these are good people, or at least they are just people that aren't necessarily going out of their way to, you know, intercept with fate or interact with fate. These are people that make mildly bad decisions, maybe, or have a mild sense of arrogance, or make some small error in some way. And the consequences, I think what's interesting about this film, the consequences are political and global, and they have everything to do with how, particularly, you can't help but see this as a criticism of the United States in terms of how its relationship with certainly its neighbor to the south, Mexico, in terms of how it deals with immigrants, illegal and legal, and with the Muslim countries in this world. I mean, it's really interesting that you have this film that one of the stories takes place in Morocco, not a Muslim nation that is known for its terrorist population. In fact, that's sort of one of the key components here. And when an event occurs, when Cate Blanchett's character is, you know, is shot, the immediate assumption, the arrogant assumption of the United States is that terrorism is involved.
Of course.
And that, if that was the only thing that the movie wants to bring its point of, there's this, you know, that how quick we are to judge a community we don't understand. But I think just the way the emotional consequences of that, I think, were profound in terms of, like, not only do we get, you know, this sort of unnamed accidental assassin, or you know, accidental assassin. Mm-hmm. You know, we get to know the community that these young kids come out of, where you know they make a mistake, and the consequences mm-hmm. for their country are global because of the way the United States
yeah.
has this perception relationship. But I have to say, like, so all of that stuff worked for me. It really did, in terms of really Arriaga and Inarritu's, what they wanted to say about our world today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they also attempted to do and succeeded in doing for me was literally make the world smaller and more familiar. I think they solve the problem that they're also, if they're condemning or like recognizing that there's a problem with the fact that we don't communicate with mm-hmm. these other groups in the world, they're also offering a solution by the way they shoot this film. I walked out of the Milwaukee cinema that I saw in Babel, and I felt like I was walking into a completely new world.
Hmm.
I felt like the time we spend at the Mexican wedding, mm-hmm. you know, or in that Moroccan farming community, or on the streets of Tokyo with these kids, you're so immersed in that
uh-huh.
experience that I think they succeed in a very sort of optimistic way of bringing you closer into the world, into the global community.
It's a really nice idea, and you articulate it well, and I agree with you. That's why I said I was with this movie for as long as I was, that I love those scenes. I love the culture, the way it's explored, the Japanese teen culture, and this specifically, these deaf-mute girls. It's really fascinating how they interact with each other and how they, you know, talk to each other, essentially, and the time at the Mexican wedding, all that stuff. I mean, again, you know their
so
intentions
moving,
are
so
good.
So funny, so human.
It's interesting. I'm there with you for all of that. But what you were saying about kind of the U.S.'s policy in the world and Morocco and Mexico, if this film was actually more interested in that and not as a dissertation, you know, not as some kind of academic exploration, but really just exploring it through characters, I think the movie would have been more interesting. But really, in the end, you have all these really interesting scenarios that add up to, again, characters being punished beyond the punishment that they deserve for their actions. And I just feel that sadism for it. For me, it just, again, it just made me really uncomfortable. And what I tried to articulate with Half Nelson when we argued about that film is how the characters in that film, and I don't know if I ultimately expressed it as well as I wanted to, but the way they never really felt flesh and blood to me, it's even worse here in this film. Everyone in this movie is a type. They become almost allegorical.
Oh, I totally disagree.
They're total types. They become stand-ins for elements or groups of society. The yuppie couple who lost a child, the Mexican immigrant housekeeper, the Moroccan farm boys, the Japanese girl with the dead mom. You can start to put together who they are just out of seeing other movies and realizing that there's kind of this shorthand being employed where we're supposed to buy into them as being flesh and blood, fully developed characters.
They're
just because we've seen this a million
absolutely
times
not.
Before.
No.
And unfortunately, I felt that this was the case with 21 Grams, is that having characters be allegorical mm-hmm. is fine. Having them essentially stand in for all of us, for all of humanity, that these different storylines and these characters are, that's fine, except that this movie is going for realism and grit in the way it's shot, in the way it's trying to say that this stuff happens every day. It's not a heightened realism. So you can't have this heightened realism and then within it have these characters just be types.
And I will say that's exactly what Inarritu is able to do. And what we saw when we saw the Three Barrels of Melquiades Estrada
mm-hmm.
earlier.
A better film.
And in Inarritu mm-hmm. Script, you saw a director that wasn't able to handle both characters that existed as types, as allegorical characters, and as real characters. Tommy Lee Jones couldn't handle it. That's what makes Inarritu's films so good. I love the way he films these communities, the way these people interact. He absolutely makes them flesh and blood.
I don't disagree with you about
absolutely
that
absolutely makes them flesh and blood.
I agree.
And they work.
Until the end. Until the last 90 minutes, when then it's just the outpouring of disaster rains down upon them.
But it
and
doesn't
it's not
really.
Interesting.
I think the movie is equally optimistic and
it tries
and
to be.
I
tries
think
to be
it, I think it legitimately is, because I walked out of the film feeling that way. Crushed and also open and feeling like that I was exposed to something new, and it made the world smaller in a good way.
I think
more
this
intimate.
Whole kind of how all these things are cosmically tied together is
I don't
played
think
out.
It's,
I think it's played out, and I think it tries to be more profound than it ultimately is. I was never into these characters, obviously, the way that you were, or these stories.
All right.
Well, if you've seen Babel and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. You can also send us an MP3 file.
When we come back, listener feedback, and Adam and I finally weigh in on Borat. You like?
He only sings when he's sad, and he's sad all the time, so he sings the whole night through. Yeah, he sings in the daytime too. He only dreams when he's sad, and he's sad all the time, so he dreams the whole night through. Yeah, he dreams in the daytime too. There may be mermaids under the water. There may even be a man in the pool. Oh, but then sometime he is running out. You better get yourself together. Out of Buffalo, the man, middle of the belt is swung, and then after the bell has rung, another cheap shot, here it comes.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and it's time now to announce this week's PeerFlix DVD giveaway winner. The DVD is Cars, just released last week, and we'd like to congratulate Jeffrey Kelly from Natick, Sam?
Natick.
Thank you.
Mass.
Help me. You're a New Englander. So
that's right.
Natick, Massachusetts. Look for your copy of Cars soon, courtesy of PeerFlix.
That's right. Sign up for a free PeerFlix account at peerflix.com/filmspotting by 6 p.m. Pacific time on Friday, November 17th. I hope you had your pencils out. And you'll be entered to win a special 3-disc edition of Park Chan-wook's Old Boy film, one of our favorites from last year.
Yes, it was.
We talked about it over and over.
If you've been holding off on signing up for a PeerFlix account, now is the time to do it.
Also out this week, Accepted.
A movie we split on a little bit.
Funny. But
not
ultimately
funny enough
not satisfying.
For you. Yeah, I thought it was satisfying.
We talked
enough
about this. I think it's just like, I think we may have laughed at the exact same things.
We did.
It wasn't enough for me to recommend it.
Just for enough for me. Yep.
Also, The Da Vinci Code, a film we didn't get to talk about on air. You actually had Scott Smith.
I did
on the
have
show.
Guest host Scott Smith. We kind of
tore
agreed, it apart.
Though. It was terrible.
Yeah.
Really boring.
It was. About as boring as the posters.
Yeah, exactly right. And then Ed Burns, The Groomsman.
Movie we reviewed and liked.
That's right. I think the seventh in the Up series, Michael Apted's Up series, 49 Up, film. I haven't seen any of them.
I haven't seen any of them. We've had a lot of listeners write in and say, you're doing this documentaries marathon. You got to talk about the 7 Up series. I've always meant to see
them. You know
him.
What?
We
actually,
will.
At this point, it'd be the perfect marathon.
It would be. You're
we
right.
Could.
Yeah.
So
it's an
2009.
Idea. There you go.
Pencil it in. John Tucker Must Die, Strangers with Candy, Who Killed the Electric Car, Lassie, Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man, and Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, all available on DVD this week. Lassie, getting some of the best reviews of the year.
You're right.
I have to say, I'm curious.
And Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, was another one people were kind of exuberant about.
Yeah.
A lot of movies there to check out.
I do hope we were able to catch up with some of these. I mean, of course, we can't see everything that comes out in 2006. I'm hoping there's a weekend, maybe in early January, where we've gotten through the big flurry of Oscar bait films
over
Christmas, and we'll have some time to catch up on some of these films.
What is a nut, Jokes?
A nut joke, I would say, that suit is black. Not.
This suit is not black.
No, not has to be the end.
Okay. This suit is black nut.
This suit is black. Pause. You know what a pause is?
Yes. This suit is black.
Okay. I'm not.
Okay, that's Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat, of course. To help set up this conversation about Borat, our delayed conversation about Borat, although now I think a lot of other people have had a chance to see it open on, I think, 800 screens first weekend, now open on all over the country. Now everyone can be equally offended all across the country in 2,000 screens, I think. We got an email from our friend Sam Oppenheim in New York, who actually, it was part of another email, but he added a PS at the end, writing, Borat is the funniest movie of the year, period. And Sam, of course, isn't alone. The movie made a surprising amount of money that opening weekend, like I said, on that limited release. And it's getting, again, surprising, rave reviews from critics. In fact, some of the best reviews of the year of any movie. And before I ask you, Adam, if you agree with Sam and critics at large, I'm reminded of our review of Snakes on a Plane back in August.
Mm-hmm.
And you admitted that the funniest thing you saw during your screening of Snakes on a Plane was the trailer for Borat. Did the movie meet your expectations?
Well, It's interesting, Sam, because I guess if you're asking me,
I wish we could go back.
I know,
and check the times that you started a review with. You know, Sam, it's interesting.
Uh-huh.
I have a feeling I know where this is going.
If you're asking me if the movie is as funny as the trailer, I don't know that it is, and I don't know that that makes any sense at all, since all the scenes are in the movie from the trailer, and it's not certainly as if the movie, I think the trailer spoiled anything for me by taking any of the best scenes. And I'm not going to rip on Borat. I'm not. I mean, hopefully we're going to have a discussion about it. We're going to talk about it here in a minute. But, you know, you're right. I thought about the trailer, too, and how I thought it was the funniest thing of the year. And before that, we thought Talladega Nights, the trailer,
yes,
was the funniest thing of the year. And
that's
we talked about it incessantly, and we laughed at the trailer every time we saw it.
Yeah.
And then we were disappointed in the film, both
right.
of us. We both liked it, but we were disappointed.
Right.
And here with Borat, I have to admit, and I don't know if we're unique or are a lot of our listeners like this, where you get so hyped up for something and then you walk out. And, you know, after the trailer set you up for it, you feel a little bit disappointed. And I walked out of both Talladega Nights and Borat being a little bit disappointed. That said, if you're asking me if it's the funniest movie of the year, yeah, it probably is. If I'm thinking about, you know,
Clerks
how many
two?
Times I laughed, I don't know. It'd be right
it
up there.
Is it funnier than Clerks 2?
Okay. You know, it's right up there with Clerks 2.
Right.
I would say that. And that's what I want to make clear. I laughed a lot at Borat. It is very funny. I recommend that everyone go see it. I've been telling everyone they should go see it.
Okay.
And we could sit here on the show and run through a litany of our favorite gags and laugh at them. But obviously that wouldn't be very interesting. I'm not going to turn into Chris Farley here going, remember the scene where Borat
that
did
awesome.
That? That was awesome. We're not going to do that. So everyone's just going to have to deal with trying to have a little bit of a critical discussion here.
That's right,
hopefully.
About Borat, yeah.
I think the reason, I just want to say, I'm interested to get your thoughts on this, Sam.
Well,
am I overthinking it? Okay,
I'm
that's fine.
Yeah.
Well, nothing unusual there. I think that, you know, the thing for me is I think maybe some people are giving it too much credit for its satire. It's one thing to just call it a really funny movie in the same way you'd look at Jackass as a really funny movie. But to give it credit as being this really satirical statement about America, I don't know, because I think that the best parts of Borat, for me, it totally flourishes when he has a target, when people who deserve to look bad are made to look bad, whether they're exposed as ignorant or bigoted or whatever. The old guy at the rodeo,
perfect
hilarious.
Example.
The frat boys in the trailer home, the RV or whatever moving down the road, that'll make you weep for the future. It's just, it's unbelievable. But too often, I felt like that the objects of the humor don't really deserve it. There's nothing really satirical there. He's just making jokes at other people's expense, which, again, I will admit is funny, but it's not brilliant satire or telling us, you know, something new and revolutionary about our country. So, you know, I think about the scene, for example, with the Southern folks at dinner. And there is this whole thing about class throughout this film. You deal with it in a lot of ways, the way he takes out a prostitute, for example, and takes her to these places, invites her to the Southern genteel home is interesting. And, you know, and he defecates literally on the Trump Tower, you know, hotel. And so there's all these interesting kind of class statements being made. But you think about these Southern folks at dinner. What's their crime, really? They're kind of naive. Okay. That they want to impress a foreigner. Okay. But pooping into a bag and handing it to him isn't great satire. It's funny, but it's not great satire. No matter how much you want to try to tie it into this critique of genteel society, it's not satire. It's just a joke, and it's a gag, and it's scatological in the same way Jackass is. And like I said, it's funny, but I don't know that this film is ultimately as insightful as some critics are rushing out to say it is.
Yeah, I completely agree. I had this strange feeling about it when I left. I was like, I laughed, but I'm not sure it's funny
mm-hmm.
in some way. Not only is it not satirical, I don't know ultimately if it was all that funny. I don't actually even recommend it.
Really?
I have to say.
I'm shocked to hear that.
I do. I was kind of bewildered by it, and I had sort of problems as I was watching it. I was like, what is wrong with this film? Because there's a lot of interesting and, I think, conflicting approaches that they have. I mean, you articulated it best when you said, when does Borat work? You know, when is Sacha Baron Cohen the most interesting to watch? It's when he has a target. You're right, that we want to see undermined in some way, or see, you know, the hypocrisy revealed, whatever it is. That is surprisingly rare in this film. And it also has this whole, you know, we know that Sacha Baron Cohen is playing Borat. We know Borat is an invented character in order to sort of get at the hypocrisies of Americans. That's his role.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what his role was on the Ali G show. But in the film, we're supposed to believe him in some way, or supposed to be interested in him as a fictional character who is a reporter from Kazakhstan, and he's here to go across America. And I'm not interested in that fictional character. So, you know, there's like this fictional element of the story that to me just isn't interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are these moments of the documentary feel when we're actually getting him interacting with people who aren't in on the joke at all. Those are the most interesting scenes. Although I do think they're kind of few and far between, and more often than not, I find that there's a kind of desperation to get the joke, you know, to get some material, and they don't always get it. I mean, I think of the, I think of him walking into the Civil War memorabilia store. Clearly, it's like, oh man, we're going to see some bigotry here.
Yeah,
you know, where are the figurines of the black people picking cotton? I was just waiting to see that.
And what do we get?
And what do we get? Him pulling a Jackass routine of just smashing everything in the store. It's a desperate act of physical comedy. And I felt like there are many scenes of that where it's like you have an interview with Alan Keyes and it's like, oh, here we go. Here he's going to we're going to get into the whole hypocrisy of homophobia. But they just he just makes a joke at Alan Keyes' expense.
And then it goes.
And then it's gone.
You're right. And there's a similar scene, Sam, with Bob Barr. He gets a sit-down in Washington. They make this entire trip to Washington, apparently, to have this one joke with Alan Keyes, and then to have this joke with Bob Barr, a senator from Georgia, I believe. And the whole joke, the whole reason he's there, is essentially to get him to take a bite of cheese and then tell him, yes, it's made by my wife's breast milk.
Right.
And it's funny, but then he's gone, and that's it. Right. I mean, so you had this entire sit-down with a senator, and that's all you could glean from
it was... What is that revealing about us?
Nothing.
And that's what I'm saying.
It's funny, but...
But that's what I'm saying. It's funny, but it doesn't really add up to anything. And I don't even think it... So there's these desperate moments, I think, where it's like, this was meant to be a satire, revealing something about America. Somewhere along the line, they're like, we've got to do whatever it takes to get laughs. We'll just have Borat and his Kazakh manager run nude through a hotel, wrestle each other nude. And I mean, there was just a that's a scene particularly where we have a sense of real desperation. This is a scene a lot of people are talking about, where you feel like they start wrestling in their hotel room to such a violent degree, they're begging the management to come in and break it up and get it on film and get their response. Management doesn't come. So what do? Let's run down the hallway and wrestle. Let's get into the elevator with some people that aren't expecting it. So the whole film, as it went on, I was just like, I started to get really annoyed by it because it was a bad Jackass knockoff.
Yeah, it is.
I really think.
In some ways.
And there were some, again, there are funny moments, surprising moments that you've seen in the trailer, and they work here too. But overall, I felt like the movie was so edited, and there are a lot of scenes, I think, where there are too many people in on the joke.
I agree. Some of the stage scenes don't work.
Totally stage. And those poor kids, I'm not going to say poor kids because they say some really offensive stuff, but the frat kids, you know, there's a new, they're suing.
Are they?
They're suing 20th Century Fox.
I was wondering how they even allowed themselves to be portrayed that way. Like, didn't they have to sign off?
It didn't surprise me at all that, they got the kids drunk, had them, filmed them, and then had them sign this waiver.
Huh.
You know, and it's just manipulative in that way. And it's like, that ruins the reality of it being documentary, too. There's no way these kids were just driving and picked up Borat on the side of the street. Mm-hmm. So it was playing by all these different rules. Fictional narrative film, real on man on the street, surprising documentary, and also pseudo-documentary. And there were just too many people that were in on the joke. Some people weren't. And I felt like it was kind of a mess. And there was this air of desperation through
the entire thing. So it was a huge disappointment for you.
Yes, it was.
I can't wait for the hate mail on this one.
Go back and seriously, go rent the first seasons of Ali G with just like the segments of Borat. It's like that's Borat at its best and at its essence.
Mm-hmm.
When you really have him, you know, one-on-one with some unsuspecting people and, you know, there's just comic gold there because his commitment to character is... It's Andy Kaufman-esque, and it's just to watch his commitment to the character, I think, is fascinating, even in the film. But I think he was used to an end that doesn't really play to Borat's strengths.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, I liked it more than you, obviously,
yes, you did.
And we want to know what you think of Borat. Send us an email. Send us a nice email, please. feedback@filmspotting.net.
If you're going to condemn me for not liking Borat, I want you to defend me for liking Babel.
No. No.
It's the only way you can write an email. It's the only way I want to hear from you.
Okay. Well, Sam, let's move on to a few other things here, some notes and some housekeeping. We want to thank, of course, everyone who was so generous as to donate a few bucks our way on the PayPal link on the filmspotting.net site. We can't name everyone here on the show, but we are going to name a few of them. And if you want to see everyone get your Sam Van Hallgren nickname, go to filmspotting.net and click on the link in the notes for this show.
That's right. A couple of people that did donate this week. We want to thank Joshua99 on the wall, B, Keith Intergalactic Steeplechase, Elizabeth the Missionary of Mayonnaise, and Kirsten the Suffragette Saint. Thank you for your donations.
And thank you, yes. Thank you to those people and to everyone who signed up to be a $2 a month subscriber. Again, your nicknames will all be on the filmspotting.net site Thank you very much. Poll question, Sam. A couple weeks ago, we asked on the show a question that was really important to possibly the future of the show. We said, hey, you're going to be possibly dictating the future of this the format.
Yes.
And we got almost 1,000 votes and a really great turnout in this poll question. And we were just curious. We said, assuming no show was longer than an hour, how often would you like to hear Film Spotting?
That's right. And we the choices were the more is better. Back to two shows a week or weekly is great. And 46% of you, nearly 50% of you, said the more the better. 34% of you said back to two shows a week. So again, the more the better, obviously. And weekly is great for 20% of you that go out jogging once a week.
You just
need an hour to get you by. And that's what we're there for. And but I think we will be seeing an opportunity, not in the immediate future, but maybe down the line, for adding a little more content.
And it is, of course, great to hear that 80% of our listeners think more is better. That's essentially whether it's two shows a week or three shows or more, they would like to hear more.
Well, we could only afford to pay just under 1,000 people to respond that way.
That is true. We could have had a better turnout with more money.
That's right.
But so, again, we thank everyone who voted in that poll question, and I'm really glad we didn't put an option that was in there that was like once a month. That's good.
Never. Is that good for you?
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, this week's poll question, we're going to be reviewing, of course, Casino Royale, the new James Bond installment. So we're curious about your thoughts about James Bond.
Yeah. So we're asking your thoughts about the Bond franchise in general, not just about your thoughts about the upcoming Casino Royale. And so we're asking you, we're sort of categorizing it by those who have played Bond. Daniel Craig, will he revitalize the franchise? Roger Moore, you're mildly interested and entertained by the Bond franchise. Timothy Dalton, a complete waste of time. Bond is boring. Or Sean Connery, only the old stuff for me. You can't beat the original.
You can't beat an original. Sam, where's your vote going right now?
Well, for two reasons, actually. I'm picking Timothy Dalton because I don't actually have a lot of interest or investment in the Bond franchise. I gave up on it when I was about 15, didn't look back. When I was 15, I was giving up on Timothy Dalton, although I have to say, License to Kill, I can't remember the other one. I didn't mind Timothy Dalton. There's all this hate for Timothy Dalton, but I remember those being interesting Bonds. I don't know what it would be like to revisit those Bonds, but
yeah.
I can't say I have a lot of love for it. In fact, I'm ashamed to admit, I didn't see any of the
Pierce Brosnan.
Brosnan.
I saw probably all of them, and he's a good Bond. I think we didn't include him in the poll question.
That's right.
But I think he's a good Bond, but the movies didn't do much for me. The Living Daylights, is that perhaps
the
other?
I think so, Living Daylights.
Dalton?
Well done.
I guess, you know, for me too, it's kind of a hybrid where I think Daniel Craig may revitalize it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm more excited about this latest Bond installment than you are, but that said, I'm probably more in the middle ground where it's kind of Roger Moore. It's like, I'm mildly interested, but ultimately I'm kind of with you. I lost interest in it, and I hope that this will bring it back. I wrote about it in the dope sheet, actually.
Yes.
I love the first 20 seconds of the Casino Royale trailer.
That is generous.
And if the whole movie, or even half of the movie, was like that 20 seconds, it's going to be one of the best films of the year. But unfortunately, you watch the rest of the trailer,
it's
GoldenEye Part 2, and I'm not interested in
that. I just came up with a theory. I think your affiliation with Bond may have something to do with when you reach your sexual maturity.
Okay.
Olivia Dabo.
Yeah.
Living Daylights or whatever the Dalton film was. I don't know if it may have been overshadowed. I don't know what happened in any of those films. I just know that Olivia Dabo was playing a cello in one of them.
And she was the sexiest woman alive for
you? She was really pretty.
At that point?
Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
Well, let's move on, Sam. We actually have so much listener feedback to get to, and we have some about the Prestige.
Maybe I should have said sexual immaturity.
That would be a better phrase there. But we have so much great feedback, and we had some about the Prestige poll. It's been several weeks now since we talked about it, and just with some of our Chicago Public Radio shows and some of the different interviews we've had, we've really gotten behind them. We have so much great feedback, especially on the scary moments and sophomore efforts last week, Marie Antoinette. The Prestige, you name it. Some of these films we've talked about.
Yeah, The Queen. Right.
So here's what we've decided to do, because we're just not going to get to it here in this show either. We have too much to talk about. What we're going to do is next week is our Chicago Public Radio show on Saturday. On Wednesday, our normal slot is our bonus show. We're going to spend the first part of that show reviewing Stranger Than Fiction and the first movie in our animation marathon, Watership Down.
That's right.
We're then going to spend the last two segments, or at least half of the show.
Half of the show, whatever it is.
We're going to devote it just to listener feedback.
That's right.
We're really looking forward to that. We're just going to get into all of your great email and voicemail responses. So it will be in our next show next Wednesday. Now, we want to close out this segment with some bad news.
Tragic news.
Actually, some really upsetting news. And it's interesting because, we talk about coincidence spotting. Well, this isn't the type of coincidence that you want to have, but it turns out that our show last week, the show we recorded from our friend's wedding in Wausau, Wisconsin, was on a Sunday. We were recording it, and I put in the movie in my top five sophomore efforts, Hal Hartley's Trust. Well, just three or four days earlier, I guess on Wednesday, November 1st, it turns out Adrienne Shelley, the star of that film, Of Trust and other indie films, she was recently in the Bukowski movie with Matt Dillon, Factotum, she died. And it looked at first like it was suicide. She had a daughter, she has a husband, kind of this tragic, she
just
hanged herself.
Filming a movie, yeah.
And she hanged herself, and it was this tragic story about her dying. And then we get news.
Yeah, within 24 hours, really.
That it's a lot actually more tragic and deeper than everyone initially thought. And it turns out it wasn't suicide, it was actually murder. And it's a really upsetting story. And I'll just briefly say that it turns out it was a construction worker she got into an argument with outside her apartment or their building or whatever. And he threw something at her. And she said she was going to call the cops. And he was in this country illegally. And to prevent her from doing that, followed her inside and killed her.
Yeah.
And it's very depressing, and we had a lot of listeners write in and say, how could you not comment on Adrienne Shelley dying when you had Trust, you know, in your top five even? It turns out
we just didn't know
at the time, and now we do. And, you know, we had a moment of silence for Sven Nykvist, the Swedish cinematographer whose name we managed to probably massacre yet again, but we honored him with a moment of silence. We'd like to do it here real quick as well for Adrienne Shelley. That's Adrienne Shelley, dead at the age of 40, and now we'd like to play a clip from the Hal Hartley film Trust featuring Adrienne Shelley. Stay with us.
Did you mean it? Would you marry me?
Yes.
Why?
Because I want to.
Not because you love me or anything like that, huh?
I respect and admire you.
Isn't that love?
No, that's respect and admiration. I think that's better than love.
How?
When people are in love, they do all sorts of crazy things. They get jealous, they lie, they cheat, they kill themselves, kill each other.
Doesn't have to be that way.
Maybe.
To be the father of a child you know isn't yours.
Kids are kids. What does it matter?
Do you trust me?
If you trust me first.
I trust you.
Sure?
Yes.
Then marry me.
I'll marry you if you admit that respect, admiration, and trust equal love.
Okay. They equal love.
Check it out, my new Gore-Tex watch. I can store 20 numbers in this watch. Tonight I'm gonna fill it. All or nothing, no compromise. Tonight I'll be the super me.
What if the super you meets the super her and the super her rejects the super you?
Then it's no problem.
Why?
Because it was never you. It was just an act. I live my life like a French movie, Steve.
What?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Last week on the podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Cameron Crowe's Singles, a tie-in with last week's top five sophomore efforts, second films. Cameron Crowe's first film, of course, being Say Anything with John Cusack. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Mark Commers in Atlanta. regular
friend,
listener.
Mark Commerce.
Nice to see Mark win. Congratulations,
That's
Mark.
Great.
Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice. And I'll also mention real quick, it's nice to actually have a scene where we say it's the scene we massacred, and it really is. I don't know how many people noticed that. The scene from The Evil Dead last week, and I made a note of it in the show notes, but the scene from Evil Dead, turns out we massacred a scene that's in the script, but not in the film. One of those convenient cases where they skip right over that part to go to a next scene. And I've seen The Evil Dead. I knew that there were, you know, a lot of scenes about what's in the cellar. I read that bit of dialogue, and I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that from the film. Obviously, a good handful of our listeners remembered it as well.
You know who will appreciate that? Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
Finally, his original script brought to life.
Yes.
Thanks to Film Spotting.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
All right, it's time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And
yes.
Sam, this time we also know that this one is actually in the film.
Yes,
we're 100% sure it's in the film. And we're going to reverse roles here a little bit.
Thankfully,
I'm going to play the woman.
After criticizing me these last couple of weeks for my performance as a woman, performance as a woman.
Too gruff. You're like Kathleen Turner. So this time,
that's right. You'll handle
I'm going to play
show me how it's done.
The woman. And this ties in with our top five this week, Strangers in a Strange Land. Culture clash movies. So think of culture clashes. And maybe even ties in with Babel a little bit, too,
I'll say.
Okay.
Let's say that.
Well, I actually start this one. You give me the action.
All right. And action.
It's just things are really complicated.
I know about blank. I know how it feels.
God, I'm so confused. It's too soon to be having feelings for you.
Maybe feelings are feelings because we can't control them.
But I have to control them because I can't go through losing somebody again. It's too painful.
So what? You're just gonna shut down?
I really like you.
There's no chance we can ever be together?
Only if you could promise me you'll never die.
You know I can't promise that.
If you did that, I would make love to you right now.
I promise I will never die.
And scene. Oh, I love that scene.
That's a good scene.
If you know what film Sam and I just massacred... Send us an email by Monday, November 20th.
I will never die.
You'll never die. Send us an email to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Wednesday's show.
I was out there.
I don't care who it was. Hey, I don't want none of your shit, man.
I'm not giving you shit.
What'd you do it for, man? What'd you throw a glass in the street?
I didn't.
And we'll get something going here. Come on up and sit around. It ain't no big thing. You ain't gonna be doing nothing no way. Crying about how broke you are like I am.
That was an unquestioned assumption. It had an idealistic flavor to it, but it was the underpinning of an imperial policy, basically. I shared the assumption very easily.
Oh, well, I know people have been very good to me, you know, Ron. Well, they've seen my condition. I guess that's what they're sorry for me. But it's real, my condition is. It's not put on, that's for sure.
They gobble quite often early. Sometimes it's 5, 10, 15 minutes, and later on in the morning, sometimes it's every 30 minutes. You just can't tell.
There's hope for a better tomorrow. Without hope, not only gays, but those blacks and the Asians, and the disabled, the seniors, the usses, without hope, the usses give up.
That was a montage of some of the moments we've recalled here on our show recently during our 6-part documentaries marathon. And before we go ahead and hand out our documentaries marathon awards, we want to take a moment just to let you know that our review of a new documentary, Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, is available on the filmspotting.net site. You can't miss it. If you go to filmspotting.net, we have about a 12 and a half minute review of that new documentary. It's open now in select cities and is actually opening in Chicago on November 24th, and we thought it was a nice tie-in with our documentaries marathon and also the last film in our marathon, Harvey Milk. There are a lot of interesting connections with Jonestown, so check that out. And let's officially close out the documentaries marathon award. Sam, we have to credit one of our listeners. I know I had it written down, and now I've lost it. Who was the listener who gave us the title?
Mike Weston
had a great thing about editing, but we had one of our listeners suggest that the documentaries marathon, we told our listeners we didn't really have a catchy name for it.
That's right.
And one of them said, you got to call it The Nanooks,
yes.
After, you know, really one of the first documentaries that people really remember, Robert Flaherty's Nanook of the North, which I have seen and is a really interesting documentary. So we are calling it The Nanooks.
That's
and
right.
Again, our apologies to the name we forgot. We'll give you,
you
credit.
You will be notated on
the site. You will be.
Right.
So let's go ahead and start. We just have a few awards here for the Docs Marathon. It's a little different than all our other categories with actor and supporting actor. And let's go ahead and start, Sam, maybe with best editing. This is something that Mike Weston, one of our listeners, wrote in and said that we should consider an award for editing because it's an even more critical component of documentaries, which often start with 100 plus hours of material. So it's more important than it even is for narrative films. And I think he's right. So
I think
let's
he's
give
right
him their
too.
Credit.
And I think I exchanged an email or two with Mike suggesting that maybe the editing award for documentaries is equivalent to the screenwriting award
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Yeah.
To a narrative film. For me, the film that exists only due to editing in some ways is Vernon, Florida. I know it's not a film you really liked. In fact, it's the one Errol Morris film you don't like,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, that you've seen so far. And I think, for me, it's all about, you know, finding a narrative thematic thread with these interviews, with these Southern old man oddballs,
mm-hmm.
and finding a way to tell the story thematically as opposed to, you know, it's certainly not a plot-driven documentary. And I think, you know, the movie succeeded for me wildly. I loved it. And it's because of the editing.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, I'm with you.
Ah.
I gave the best editing Nanook to Vernon, Florida, because even though I didn't like the film, as we discussed, we thought that Morris really came up with an ingenious and crucial, it turns out there would be no documentary without it, as you suggested, without finding a way to edit this film together and all this material around themes. And the way he does that is really fascinating. If ultimately the movie didn't have much of an impact on me, I agree with you. I give it best editing. And for people who may be tuning in for the first time to the show or new to the show, aren't familiar with this marathon, let's just briefly mention, we watch 6 classic documentaries we were always ashamed we had never seen. Many of our listeners followed along. And the documentaries were, we'll briefly name them, Don't Look Back, Harlan County, USA, 2 Errol Morris films, Gates of Heaven and Vernon, Florida. And then we had The Times of Harvey Milk, right before Harvey Milk was...
Well, then we had Hearts and Minds.
Hearts and Minds,
right.
The Peter Davis documentary.
Right.
Okay, so those were the films. We've given out our best editing Nanook. Now let's do best character.
Best character.
Best personality in a documentary.
If we agreed on Vernon, Florida for best editing, there's no way we don't agree on the best character.
We'll see.
You know, sort of best performance by an interview subject.
You're giving it to the turkey guy, aren't you?
Oh, no way. No,
okay.
No, it's got to be Florence Rasmussen. And I want to hear... read from Roger Ebert, who declares Gates of Heaven one of his favorite films of all time. His original review, Gates of Heaven: the centerpiece of the film is an extended monologue spoken by a woman named Florence Rasmussen, who sits in the doorway of her home overlooking the first Pet Cemetery. William Faulkner and Mark Twain would have wept with joy to have created such words as fall from her mouth as she tells the camera the story of her life. She paints the details in quick, vivid sketches and then contradicts every single thing she says. It is an amazing character. And I think, again, Morris uses it kind of ingeniously as a doorway to the next, to the second part
he
of
does.
His film.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really doesn't belong in either. And,
no.
it can, and he knew it was total
it was
gold. You
yeah.
can't not use it.
Right.
And the way he uses it,
he
I
found
think,
a way
found
to
a
fit
way.
It in. Okay, well, I love that scene as well and that character, but I didn't use her. I picked someone else, actually, from Gates of Heaven. I went with Dan Harberts,
the
youngest son who runs this pet cemetery.
You loved him.
He's so soulful and sensitive, and he seems a little lost in life. You just can't help but feel for him, but he's really good at what he does. And the fact that he's heartbroken, he talks about how he had this relationship end and it just destroyed him, and you really get the sense that, I mean, we all have relationships end, but this, like, crushed him.
Yeah.
This truly crushed him. And I think that you could make an entire documentary just about him that would be fascinating. So for me, he's my best character.
Not to mention, I mean, I don't think I didn't consider Bob Dylan eligible for
okay.
this. Okay.
Because he's real.
Yeah, he's real. And he's obviously, I think, the most fascinating character.
They're all real,
in the marathon.
But he's an icon. Yeah.
Harvey Milk, of course. But just to mention a couple others, I mean, even Hearts and Minds is not a film we like. Daniel Ellsberg.
Oh, yeah.
William Westmoreland. Fascinating characters
sure.
that make some of these films worth seeing.
You're right. And maybe they would fall into this next category more, which is best moment. We're
yeah.
giving a Nanook to kind of the best moment you'd only find in a documentary. Right. What moment, what one moment stands out for you, Sam, from this entire marathon?
Yeah, to further clarify, I think it is like that scene that reminds you that truth will always be more interesting than fiction in some way. And it's interesting. This is, I struggled with this, but I had to go back to a scene we talked about a lot when we were reviewing Don't Look Back. And it is the scene where Donovan strums one of his hits. It's a crowded room. It's late at night. And then Bob Dylan asks for the guitar, and he plays It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and he might as well be saying It's All Over Now, Donovan, because you will never be this good. And it's like that weird sense of, you know, he's not really trying. It's not like a it's not a showdown, but it's very quietly, you know, exhibiting his authority as a musician. And like we said, you don't know what Donovan was thinking when they pan over to him after It's All Over Now, Baby Blue is over with, but it's easy to imagine
it is.
That he realizes he'll never be that
They're
good.
Both kind of alpha dogs in their own way, but Dylan's much more passive about it. And as it turns out, I had that exactly in my award, too. That was my award, goes to that scene. But actually, I'm giving it to that whole kind of scene because even more than, you know, not just that moment, but the sequence. Because for me, as much as it is fun to watch that showdown, for me, the moment that will always stick out is just, we've seen Dylan throughout this whole documentary be so passive and laid back and never get aggressive. And then he gets into the face of Donovan and his people about who threw a bottle out the window. He thinks he's going to get in trouble because someone threw a bottle out the window and he's going to get blamed for it. And he's livid about it. And just, I'll never forget hearing Dylan, you know, just yell at them, who threw that bottle? You know, and just getting crazy about it and being right up in their faces. That whole moment for me, and then ending, culminating with, as you said, the great guitar showdown, that makes that scene for me also my Nanook. So let's close out, Sam, with Best Picture.
Okay, well, I loved a lot of the films in this marathon. I loved Gates of Heaven. I loved Vernon, Florida. But I'm giving it to D.A. Pennybaker. I'm giving it to Don't Look Back. I found the whole thing completely fascinating. I love Bob Dylan, and I admitted at the time, I don't know how much this film would mean to somebody that isn't all that interested in Dylan's work or Dylan as a music icon. But I do admire his music. I love his music, and I found this completely fascinating. I think I essentially watched the film back to back. It was so fascinating with the director's commentary, and it's just, I mean, it just captured image after image, even though it didn't have necessarily the sort of, you know, narrative or thematic ambition of a Morris film. What it was able to capture was totally incredible.
Well, for me, it was very difficult as well, because I think I gave 4 stars to every film in this marathon except
Hearts and
to,
Minds.
That's true, Hearts and Minds and Vernon, Florida. So 4 of the 6 films I gave 4 stars to, and it was really hard, but ultimately I'm giving it to Harlan County, USA. I think really, of all of the movies, I think it's the most important. I had certain issues with maybe, I thought the music, she overdid it a little bit. I thought there were, you know, a few things about it that didn't always work for me, but I think it's the most important, and I think that just watching that whole thing where we talk about the form of these documentaries and kind of piecing together a story afterwards, well, for me, what makes Harlan County so vital is the way it's documenting a story as it's unfolding. And so it has much more life and vitality and just political, you know, aspirations, of course, than Don't Look Back does. For me, it's more emotionally charged and politically charged. And I think it's just, as I said, an important film. It's, for me, the most interesting documentary we watched of the 6. So that's my Best Picture.
That's a very, Nanook. Very safe pick.
We also want to mention, we said in the last segment that we've got a lot of listener feedback. We'll get to some of your documentary marathon listener feedback also in that next bonus show.
Next week, we'll kick off our 6-week animation marathon with Martin Rosen's Watership Down. We're going to take one more quick break. Adam, did you happen to catch the professional football contest on television last night?
No, I didn't.
Oh, the Giants of New York took on the Packers of Green Bay. And in the end, the Giants triumphed by kicking an oblong ball made of pigskin through a big H. It was a most ripping victory. Our top 5 Culture Clash movies are next. Stay with us.
Don't they love you in mysterious ways? You say, yeah, but this is now and that was then. Put a dollar into the machine and you'll remember when. I know when everything feels wrong. I've got some hard proof in this song. All knowing everything feels right.
We're back on Film Spotting, this rather long-winded edition of Film Spotting, but we had a lot to cover.
Yes.
Now we're going to focus solely on our top five, a top five that actually was suggested to us by a listener, Sam, it turns out. Elliot Levitt from Ann Arbor, Michigan, wrote in and said, how about for the show with Borat, you do your top five culture clash movies? And of course, it ties in perfectly with Babel. We thought that was a great idea. I actually wrote it to you as Strangers in a Strange Land. And so however you want to phrase it, that's the top five. And I will admit that at first I almost said, maybe we do a show, Sam, without a top five.
I said, blasphemy.
You gasped and said, there's no way our listeners will allow that. I didn't want to do this top five for some reason.
You want a mutiny on your hands?
I know. I was nervous about it. And then the more I got into it.
Let them eat reviews. That's what you said.
That's exactly what I said. And then the more I thought about it, I realized, I love this top five. In fact, this is going to be impossible for me to whittle my list down, and it was very hard. So I had a fun time with this list. I can't wait to jump into it, actually. So let's get into it. What movies for you just missed the cut, Sam, of your culture clash films?
Sure. Quickly, I wanted to say with my criteria, it was interesting because we originally did call it the Strangers in a Strange Land list and then Culture Clash. And it was interesting how I was able to whittle down my list was by first going through all the movies that fit the Strangers in a Strange Land category. And if you interpret that loosely, that could be just about every movie ever made.
Yeah.
Who's uncomfortable in somebody else's company. But then once I applied the Culture Clash criteria, immediately, a ton.
I did the same thing. I'll just briefly add that I did the same thing. For example, I thought of a movie, even like a movie I love, Almost Famous. You could argue with Strangers in a Strange Land, this young kid being immersed in this rock and roll groupie world, but it's not really a culture clash film. So I also try to use that as kind of the limiting
criterion.
So let's go ahead. You're 6 through 10.
All right, quickly. I mean, you mentioned a couple of films recently that would apply. I think Marie Antoinette applies, and I'm putting it in my 6 through 10. The young Austrian princess is matched with the equally young French prince. The Limey, a favorite. Steven Soderbergh, of course, the Cockney criminal, comes to L.A. to avenge his daughter's death. I've got Cabaret on here.
I thought of it. I almost had it.
Yep. I mean, where the only defense to the rise against the Nazi party is this group of decadent cabaret singers and intellectuals, this clash of culture and politics and history.
Sure, and the British guy who comes to Germany.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've also got Starman on here.
Oh, I love
course.
Starman.
What's
Jeff
your favorite
Bridges.
Line? Give it to me.
Dutch apple pie. Terrific.
And then I have Babe, Pig in the City.
Wow.
The very embodiment of sincerity and good ends up facing the corruptive forces of the big city.
Okay.
It's a good one.
Fascinating
stuff. It's a good one if you
haven't seen
it. It is
a good pick. A movie that has never been in a top five on our show.
That's right.
Okay. Well, that's going to be a theme, Sam, coming up.
Looking forward to that.
Never been in a top five. My 6 through 10, the movies that just missed it. I've got Witness, a film I've mentioned before, Peter Weir from 1985, a religious movie, tragic love stories, Harrison Ford hiding out with the Amish people and learning about their culture. I've also got The Passenger. Film's been briefly mentioned on the show. Michelangelo Antonioni's film recently released, re-released, or put out on DVD with Jack Nicholson. This is more of a Stranger in a Strange Land film than it is culture clash. It's also more of a movie about starting over. I don't know how I left it off that top five. I've also got John Sayles' film Brother from Another Planet with Joe Morton, an escaped slave from a distant planet who arrives in Harlem and can't speak and tries to assimilate to the culture. And I've got on here, Sam, I left it out of the top five just to avoid a fight. The Last King of Scotland. You can hear our
battle.
I knew
it would be on there. That's the only reason we're doing this.
You can hear our
battle.
That's
how I convinced you to do a top five. I was like, oh, you could put Last King of Scotland
you
in your top five.
The showdown about The Last King of Scotland is on Film Spotting 131. You can hear our follow-up fight on 133. But some of our kids in our message boards, it upset them to hear Mommy and Daddy
mommy
fighting.
And Daddy fight.
I don't want to talk about who Mommy was. But anyway, Last King of Scotland. And lastly, Sam, I wonder if you made the jump and put it in. I had to throw on In America. And the only reason I didn't put it in the top five is because I feel like we talk about this film too much. But again, I looked at our top five list. Because we are so afraid of it, it's only been in our top five a combined four times. And the last time it was mentioned was episode number 92.
I know.
So it's not like we talk about it too much, but it is a film we love. I actually wonder, I'm throwing out there right now, does it go into the pantheon? Do we put In America in the forbidden list
it's been recommended.
Godfather and Citizen Kane and Star Wars and say,
and Jim Sheridan's In America.
Yeah.
Why not? I think probably part of the reason, you know, it's one of these things that comes up as a possible Pantheon candidate is because every time we talk about it, we talk about how we don't use it much and there's
right,
this big
exactly.
preface.
And how we left it off for this
exactly.
reason.
Exactly. Okay. All right, well, I'll head right into my top five, and I guess I didn't know it was going to infuriate you at the time, but it's a tie, including Inarritu's Babel, with Michael Winterbottom's The Road to Guantanamo, another film from 2006. Two films that depict the grave consequences that result from the chronic sense of distrust between cultures and nations. And it's not a scene I talked about during a review of Babel, but the scene, and it's toward the end, and you have this young Moroccan boy coming up to these officials saying, it was me, I'm the only one who shot you, just save my brother.
Uh-huh.
And not only is that a really moving scene, I think, but it also works on this this level of, you can just picture it as a voice from the Muslim countries of the world saying, like, look, I am one small boy. I made a mistake. USA, stop condemning my entire region in a way. I don't know. I found it very moving on that level. Anyway, so those both fit in there. Certainly, you know, we haven't really talked about Road to Guantanamo much,
no.
But about these three Pakistani men who find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time and end up, you know, spending 3 years in jail, including at Guantanamo. I mean, one of the most powerful and just incredible films this year.
Okay. Well, before I say my number five, I am briefly reminded, Sam, I wanted to mention to you that one of the joys, of course, of being now an official Chicago film critic is I get DVD screeners in the mail.
What'd you get?
Guess what I just got in the mail the other day? I got The Last King of Scotland, which now I have and I own. And so I was watching it over the weekend. I was going through it like the Zapruder film.
You were not.
Zapruder film, just back into the left. Just all my favorite scenes.
This is
it was
like
the greatest hits.
You're saying you're comparing a greatest hits to the Zapruder film. I love it. I think you mixed your metaphors there.
Of course, I was actually just trying to infuriate you. I haven't broken
like
the seal yet.
This is like a 12-round bout.
It is
not over, people.
But it's going to happen. Someday I'm just going to sit down and watch my favorite scenes over and over again. I love that arrogant Scottish kid. Okay.
I love how he exploits the people of Uganda.
I love it, especially, yes. My number five, Sam, let's get serious, or kind of serious, with a little musical introduction.
Ingrid Bergman, let's go make a picture on the island of Stromboli. Ingrid Bergman, you're so pretty. You'd make any mountain quiver. You'd make fire fly from the crater. Ingrid Bergman.
That's Billy Bragg and Wilco from one of my favorite albums, Mermaid Avenue, singing the song Stromboli. And that is my number five film, Stromboli, from 1950, Roberto Rossellini making his first and last film for Hollywood. So you've got the culture clash there of the story, which I'll talk about in a minute, but you've also got Rossellini coming to Hollywood and having this disaster of trying to make his first film. It's the story about Ingrid Bergman's character, Karen. She's a war refugee, and she's in this internment camp, and she agrees to get out by marrying a fisherman who lives on this island of Stromboli and basically finds that life there isn't much better. Really amazing film for its final sequence where the land becomes the metaphor for all of Karen's inner turmoil, really something that you'll always remember, really surreal. And it's interesting as well, this film, for the affair between Rossellini and Bergman that ruined her marriage, caused a scandal, and ultimately crushed this film at the box office. So it is an interesting film, though, and I want to quickly read, Sam, if you'll indulge me for a second.
Of course.
A little trivia, a little game here. I want to read you a quick bit of a review of this film, and you tell me what filmmaker we recently talked about on the show this sounds just like. This is from John Flouse, a critic writing in 2000. Rossellini's camera covers the film with few cuts or tight framings, while the interaction between characters may seem superficial, lacking the familiar layers of development. Essentially, he tells his story without expression. Dialogue does not explore its subject matter. Actors don't act so much as they behave. Images are not beautiful pictures of their subjects, though sometimes the subject may be intrinsically beautiful, land, sea, a human face, etc. My question to you then is, sound familiar?
Sounds like Sofia Coppola
to
me.
It does, doesn't it? Okay, well, you'll find similarities there if you watch Stromboli.
Foreign filmmakers for 800.
There you go.
Alex Adam. All right, my number four is Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, Johnny Depp as William Blake, this mild-mannered accountant from Cleveland, Ohio, who comes to the sort of industrial Wild West, this place of loose morals, violence, and bloodshed. And this, what you have, the sort of culture clash are between these themes and the people that that represent those themes of poetry and peace and these ideals. And these people, you know, including Johnny Depp, of course, and Gary Farmer as the Native American nobody, conflicting with these characters who embody violence and bloodshed and modernization at any cost, including Gabriel Byrne and Alfred Molina and many others. And the film is this wonderful sort of study of modernization, or the sort of inevitability of modernization, and kind of just a poetic look at a time in our past, this revisionist poetic look at the Western in history. Mm-hmm. And certainly fits that criteria.
Yeah, a great film, without a doubt. Well, my number four, I'm continuing my theme of, I thought, well, how could I really infuriate Sam? I could either just put The Last King of Scotland as my number one, or I could try to come up with as many movies as possible. I could try to shame him by coming up with as many movies as possible that have never been mentioned in a top five. And here is another one like Stromboli, though it was, I will say, an overlooked DVD pick of the week once way back. My number four film is The Dreamers from another Italian director, this one from Bernardo Bertolucci. 2003, Michael Pitt, who we loved in The Last Days, stars as an American student studying in Paris. He meets Ava Green, or as Sam calls her affectionately.
Freckles.
And her brother, who have a very interesting, very close relationship. It's a movie about sexual awakening, about cinematic awakening as well, and a political one, as it's set in Paris, 1968, time of tremendous upheaval. And the best scenes for me are the ones of these people just loving cinema and quoting movies and reenacting scenes from movies. If you love film, I think you will love The Dreamers.
Very interesting movie. Blazing new ground here in our top five. My number three, actually, let's play a quick clip here.
I want the Opera House. I want my Opera House! I want the Opera House! This church remains closed to this town!
That's the madman Klaus Kinski as Fitzcarraldo in Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo. And I think you could equally say, you were talking about filmmakers that are engaged in a kind of culture clash in the making of the film, or the fallout of making the film. You could certainly say that not only does Fitzcarraldo fit, but also, of course, the making of Fitzcarraldo, which was documented in a film, Burden of Dreams, by Les Blank. But certainly you've got Fitzcarraldo, Klaus Kinski. Not only is he in conflict with the industrial Europeans in South America as this dreamer, visionary madman, but also, of course, clashing with the Indian tribe.
The
He's hired the natives to haul his steamboat over the mountain. And, of course, you've got Herzog himself clashing with just about everybody in South America.
Life imitating
in
art.
In order to get the thing.
Yeah, okay. Great choice. I considered certainly Aguirre, The Wrath of God, is
Absolutely.
Another film that could go on this list. Well, two more films here. I've got a tie, Sam. They are connected. Two more films that we've never had in a top five before, either of us. Two movies about Northerners coming down to the South. I've got In the Heat of the Night and My Cousin Vinny. And My Cousin Vinny
is your number three?
It's my number three.
I love it.
Because it's a tie. It's my number three. And, you know, Vinny is one of these films that could be a guilty pleasure, but the fact is I don't feel guilty about it. I think it's hilarious. Mm-hmm. And I watch the final scene, the final courtroom scene of that film every time it's on TV, just like I watch the final showdown in Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino. Anytime it's on, I have to watch it. Same thing with My Cousin Vinny. And Heat of the Night, In the Heat of the Night, won Best Picture in 1967, the Norman Jewison film. Just brilliant performances by Rod Steiger and Sidney Poitier, who at times I find really infuriating because I think he overacts like crazy. But then there are moments that make up for the overacting moments so much. Like there's a scene where he's in a jail cell with this guy named Harvey who distrusts him. He's a white guy, and he's kind of spouting this racist stuff at him. And Poitier just sits there staring at him, not blinking, not saying a word. And finally, when he hears enough, he does a little hand gesture, and then he says, "Harvey, now be cool." And it's perfect. You know, like, stay cool, Harvey.
Yeah.
I'm on your side. And it's gold. I mean, it's an amazing moment. But obviously, you have this film about prejudice in this Mississippi town. And, you know, it's an interesting film where the mystery, the crime at the core of this film ultimately really isn't that satisfying. And I don't know if it's even that well handled. But what the story is about, these culture clashes, the prejudice, is really fascinating with, again, great performances.
That's great. Well, it seems like your list was created solely to taunt me. And I hope this, my number two, taunts you for leaving it out. The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Ah.
What greater gulf exists than between the glitzy world of the Hollywood silver screen and Depression-era America? Of course, you have Mia Farrow, the woman obsessed with the glamour of the movies, in a bad marriage with Danny Aiello. Her life suddenly changes when Jeff Daniels' Tom Baxter, the dashing main character of the movie within the movie, walks off the screen. And really, it's his culture clash, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he comes from this fantasy world
into real life.
And, you know, what happens when she falls in love with a person that's not real in some way, too?
Great film.
It's probably
inspired choice.
An inspired pick.
Okay,
yes.
Good job. Well, my number two, this is the one film on the list that has definitely appeared in a top five before. Orson Welles, 1958, Touch of Evil. Charlton Heston kind of humorously playing a Mexican-born cop who's on his honeymoon in Mexico.
Humorously or humorlessly?
Humorously, because he's trying to play a Mexican. in Mexico with Janet Leigh, his new bride, and you know, discovers that the rules of law down in Mexico are a little bit different under Sheriff Hank Quinlan, played by a ginormous Orson Welles. And, of course, the cinematography is brilliant. The directing is brilliant. I had it on my scores list. I just want to mention this because one listener wrote in. I couldn't find the email either, but I know some listener wrote in and said, "How can you put the Henry Mancini score from Touch of Evil on your best scores list when Welles didn't even want it. And there's been like four versions of this movie, and the one that just recently came on a DVD that was following the 58-page memo or something that Welles wrote to the studio, it made all those changes. It takes out from the opening shot, the brilliant opening long take, it takes out the Henry Mancini music. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know if it works or not.
But
the fact is, I'll just simply say, I don't care if Welles wanted it or not. I don't like the idea of studios jumping in and interfering with an artist's work, but I'll always link that music to that scene. I think it works brilliantly, and I don't care whether Welles wanted it or not. It's brilliant, and it's my number two.
It's a good pick. All right, my number one. This movie is probably the best overt definition of culture clash, and it is 2005's The New World, Terrence Malick. Of course, you've got John Smith and the other 17th century European explorers coming to this foreign land, and the culture clash with as much the place itself, the land itself, the inhospitability of the land, as well as it is with the native people, of course. And then you have John Smith's uneasy peace with the tribe, I want to say the Algonquin tribe.
Maybe.
And learning their customs, and then Pocahontas marrying this Englishman, Christian Bale, and really her trip to England. And I think we talked about this during a review. As the audience, certainly me as an audience member, I arrived with the same sense of awe, the overwhelming sense of awe that she does, that Pocahontas does, arriving on the shores of England, having spent all that time, the first half of that film, you know, in this new world, you know, dominated by nature, the Herzogian nature in some sense, and then arriving to see these perfectly, this perfect architecture of Europe, I mean, is just completely overwhelming. And certainly the way she tries to, you know, she loses a sense of her identity due to this clash.
Yep. A great choice, one I completely even forgot to put in my list of possibilities. I'm shamed. Thank you, Sam. Well, now I'll make up for it. You don't know how much it gives me great pleasure to play this clip.
Oiga, señor. We are federales, you know, the mountain police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Better not come any closer.
That is The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, 1948, John Huston. We don't need no badges. And this is a film that when we left it off of our top five movies about money. Got inundated with emails, and rightfully so. Well, I have since seen the classic John Huston film, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and it is brilliant. I'm staying in Mexico along with Touch of Evil here. John Huston won Oscars for directing and screenplay. Completely deserved. His dad, Walter Huston, won a supporting actor award for playing this old prospector named Howard, who's seen it all, takes Humphrey Bogart up into the mountains. He's amazing in it. And the movie starts with them down in Tampico, Mexico, and Bogey's line that he keeps using on John Huston as an actor in the film is, "Can you stake a fellow American to a meal?" Whether it's the federales or the bandits, the environment is just never safe for these people. It's inhospitable, Sam, to use your word.
It's inhospitable.
And Bogey is completely unbelievable in this film. And I especially like Tim Holt, who plays Curtin, who is Bogey's less greedy, less paranoid partner. He's really amazing. And I looked at the other films he's been in. None of them really jumped out to me. He's really fascinating here. So culture clash films. You got these Americans looking for gold down in the rough lands of Mexico. It's a great film, a classic.
You saved the best for last. All right. Well, opening in wide release this weekend, Daniel Craig debuts as James Bond in Casino Royale. The makers of Babe and Babe, Pig in the City, Culture Clash return with the animated Penguin movie Happy Feet, which I want to see.
Yeah. Sorry. Go see it then. Have fun.
And Dax Shepard and Will Arnett star in Bob Odenkirk's Let's Go to Prison. Plus, in limited release, Richard Linklater's Fast Food Nation. Next week, two episodes of Film Spotting. As we said, reviews of Stranger Than Fiction and Watership Down, and a huge marathon edition of listener feedback. And on Saturday, we'll post our monthly Chicago Public Radio show featuring reviews of Casino Royale and Fast Food Nation.
Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can give us a call, 206-203-2463, and leave a message. Check out our Top 5 archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting on the right side. Also on our blog on the right side, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
Thanks to M. Ward and Merge Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap your unwanted DVDs for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
and they don't always get it. I mean, I think of the, you know, the setup of him walking into a Civil War memorabilia,
antique shop, Sam.
Civil War memorabilia. And the culture clash with as much the place itself, the land, and the inhospitality. Mm-hmm. Inhospitality.
Inhospitability.
There's no way I could say that.
Try it. We're really looking forward to that. We're just going to get into all of your great email and voicemail responses. So it will be in the next show next Wednesday.
That's right. All right. Well, we will get, like we said, just to a couple emails here about The Prestige. This one from...
No, we're not getting to it. That's what I'm saying is we're
not. I wasn't listening to you.
Yeah. No.